This is Regionally Speaking, this is Reporter Roundtable Thursday, and for now we're going to turn to a new voice here on the program, a reporter in Northwest Indiana who is joining us from her post as the Michigan City News Dispatch reporter. Kelly Smith, thank you and welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there are a number of stories that you have done. I'm not going to call them a series, although they are kind of linked together because they all come from the city of Michigan City, and they all deal with city government, and they all talk about hiring practices and the like. I will let you kind of explain that because they seem to follow each other here. How did it all get started with the controversy that I guess that some people in the community had posted about how the city government hires people and get projects done?
Okay. Well, I would say that it actually started some time ago in 2017, but it came into public conversation at the June 4th Board of Works meeting here in town.
Mm-hmm.
On the agenda for that meeting, Reese Riley Construction Company was appealing three fines that Mayor Ron Meir had imposed for projects that they completed on city contract jobs. Different construction projects in town in which the mayor said, based on information he received from our human rights department, that this company had failed to comply with the local hiring ordinance, which requires that all of our city contract jobs worth $150,000 or more, 50% of the wages paid on those jobs be paid to Michigan City residents. So the nutshell version is that Reese Riley, on four of their jobs that they did for the city last year, did not pay 50% in wages to Michigan City residents.
Mm-hmm.
Human Rights Department said, you know, there needs to be a consequence for that. They asked the mayor to suspend the company. The mayor had the option of suspending or fining. He chose to fine them. And he issued fines on those four projects of $7,500 apiece. And Reese Riley, their recourse to appeal any fines they feel are not justified is to go through the Board of Works. So that's how it came to enter the public conversation, because, as you know, we cover things like the Board of Works meetings, city council meetings, things like that.
Right. I understand. I was going to say, I understand that Mayor Meir has suspended a contractor, but he does his best to not do so if he absolutely has to. I guess that has to be a pretty serious situation, doesn't it?
It has to be pretty serious, especially if they're local.
Yeah.
He is the only Michigan City mayor who has suspended a company for not complying with the local hiring ordinance. That company was based out of Niles, Michigan. And I believe the project was something to do with 212 in 2014. I can't speak on that too much because I wasn't around then. But he's the only one who's done that. Now, Reese Riley is more of a local contractor. Mayor Meir says, you know, in his public conversations, private conversations, he's very adamant about not wanting to suspend local contractors who are people that often bid on city jobs, who are capable of, you know, deploying within an hour's notice in the event of some kind of emergency. So he was saying and this is just from a phone call I had with him last week. He said, you know, if a 40-inch sewer line busts in your neighborhood and there's sewage flowing into your basement, who do I call? If everyone locally is suspended, then I have to call someone from South Bend or Fort Wayne or Chicago, and it may take them hours, if not days, to get here. So he had the Human Rights Department is kind of who oversees the local hiring ordinance. He had them rewrite that in 2015. As I said, he did suspend that one company. I think it was 2014. In 2015, he had them rewrite the ordinance to include the option to fine instead of suspend. And that's why.
Now tell us, in the articles that you put out in print as well as online, what seemed to start this whole hubbub outside City Hall that brought this all to light now?
Well, backing up to that June 4th Board of Works meeting, a few local pastors actually from the Northwestern Indiana Ministers Conference, they spoke to appeal to the Board of Works to follow through with these fines. Again, the mayor imposed the fines. The company had the option to appeal them through the Board of Works. The pastor stood up and said, Board of Works, please make them pay these fines. Make them adhere to the local hiring ordinance. Not only were they expressing their desire that Michigan City residents be paid on these jobs, this specific set of pastors, their concern also is that they don't perceive the minority representation on city contract jobs to be reflective of the demographics of Michigan City. There's a pastor, Pastor Damon Carnes. He spoke at length about how he's been involved with, he's on the Redevelopment Commission as well here in Michigan City, and I believe he was involved with the Oversight Committee on the local hiring ordinance. So he's very close to this issue, and he was saying he would like to see more people of color on these jobs. He made some comments about how black people and brown people in Michigan City, you know, they're sick and tired of being sick and tired. And when you have people who are experiencing this hopelessness, this job hopelessness, that's how you get a Ferguson. That's how you get a Baltimore. Well, when you say words like Ferguson and Baltimore, it ruffles some feathers, right? There's a lot of unrest there. And so the following night, which would have been the June 5th city council meeting, the mayor's wife, they responded. And basically, criticized Carnes for bringing up, for equating the unrest in places like Baltimore and Ferguson, where people are upset about unarmed black men being shot and killed, and trying to equate that with a local construction company not paying out 50% of wages. And then also the pastor, Pastor Carnes, he specifically called out Mayor Muir in his comments at that first Board of Works meeting. And again, in the Board of Works meeting last week, and then again in the City Council meeting last week, and in his protest, in fact, when he was protesting outside City Council, and that protest, I should back up, that protest was in response to the Board of Works overturning those fines set by the mayor.
Well, I understand, too, that and you've got an update here on that story and goes into more detail here, I guess, what actually happened as a result of the all the controversy that came out the first time around. How did this situation involving Reese Riley Construction Company finally get resolved?
As far as the resolution, on Reese Riley's end, they conceded to one of the fines. They said, you know, we messed up here. We'll pay this fine. And then the other three, the Board of Works overturned at their June 18th meeting. So Reese Riley is free to, you know, pay the one fine and continue bidding on city contract jobs and fulfilling local work as needed. On the other end of things, where Pastor Carnes and Mayor Muir are going back and forth, I actually talked to each of them separately. I talked to Mayor Muir last Thursday. I talked to Pastor Carnes this Monday or Tuesday, I believe.
Right.
And so the mayor is saying that he agrees with Pastor Carnes that it would be nice to see the local workforce reflect the local population, especially on city contract jobs. But what he was also saying is that these construction companies, they approach different unions to get qualified workers on their jobs. If they're able to prove that they've contacted all of these different places in an effort to employ Michigan City residents, and in the case of the three overturned fines for Reese Riley, they were able to prove that they had done that. They had contacted these different unions. The union said, we don't have anyone from Michigan City for you right now. Not that they aren't employing Michigan City residents, but a lot of them are already on jobs elsewhere outside the city or other jobs within the city. So the mayor was saying, well, if the pastors are so concerned about their parishioners and local people of color not being on these jobs, instead of criticizing local government, which is limited in its power, we can only do so much, maybe it would make sense for him to take this up with the unions. If he feels like the unions aren't employing people of color, that I can't do anything about that, the city can't do anything about that. If they feel like there are qualified people who aren't getting these jobs, maybe they need to be the ones helping get Michigan City residents of color or otherwise to these tests that they need to take to get into the unions and to get into the apprenticeships.
Yeah.
So that was his kind of suggestion. And then when I spoke to Pastor Carnes this week and kind of recapped with him my conversation with Mayor Mayer, he agreed. He said, you know, maybe this is the wrong door. I said, do you think maybe you're barking up the wrong tree here? This is what the mayor said. And he said, maybe we are, but we're going to bark up every tree and we're going to open every door until we find the right door to get this resolved. After the protest that he staged outside, and again, the protest was in response to those fines being overturned, or dismissed or waived or whatever you want to say.
Right.
After that protest ended outside City Hall on Tuesday, Pastor Carnes and several of his supporters came inside and addressed the council. Six out of the eight of them there spoke publicly on record saying, hey, you know, if we can help you address this situation, we would like to do that. We're happy to meet with you. We're happy to talk with you. And he seemed appeased by that. They seem willing to talk. He seemed willing to talk. I talked to him again yesterday, actually, to see if any meeting has been scheduled. He said that Council President Don Przybylinski called him from out of town. I believe he's in Indianapolis.
Right.
Called him to say when he comes back, he's going to meet with the Oversight Committee, and they're going to see what they can do. They're going to bring in the Minister's Conference to talk with them as well. And Pastor Carnes, I believe he said he hopes that should be done, that meeting should be scheduled within the next week.
That's right. We're talking with Kelly Smith, who's a reporter for the Michigan City News-Dispatch, about the stories that she's had in print as well as online here on Reporters Roundtable Thursday. And I know, too, Kelly, that there is it's a different, but it is a related story in a way to what we've been talking about here, where you put in a story here about a former city employee who had some rather sharp words about the mayor concerning, I guess, the hiring ordinance violators, and something that kind of tied things together with campaign contributions. Tell us about that story, please.
Yes. Okay. So last week in the city council meeting, Jeff Deitch, he's the former executive director of our human rights department. He's the guy who rewrote the ordinance at the mayor's request back in 2015. So he's extremely close to this issue. He's very knowledgeable about what's going on in terms of how the local hiring ordinance works. I think it's important to note, I don't know if I ever even said in my story, but when the pastor's group, the minister's conference, accused Reese Riley of maintaining some racist hiring practices, Jeff Deitch stood up and said, no, in my experience working with them, that's not the case at all. So he got up, I think, partially to defend Reese Riley, to say, I know firsthand that that's not happening. And then he got up, on the other hand, to agree with the minister's conference that he feels the mayor's inaction in terms of suspending these companies is to blame for why they continue not to employ local workers. And he offered his own potential reason for why that might be by saying that, or by frankly accusing the mayor of refusing to suspend companies who donate to his mayoral campaign by funding things like his annual mayor's ball and the mayor's annual golf outing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the mayor was not present at the meeting to respond to that one way or the other, but we did speak on the phone a day or two after that. And he said, you know, not one red cent from the mayor's ball or the golf outing has ever gone to his campaign or anyone else's. That sure, you know, those companies may sponsor holes, they may donate to the mayor's ball, things like that, but 100% of the proceeds from those events are donated to a predetermined organization or organizations every year. Like this year, for instance, the golf outing in September, I think they've already got it set at the Michigan City Zoological Society,
mm-hmm.
and then Homeward Bound. So any proceeds raised through the golf outing are going to be split equally between the Zoo Society and Homeward Bound.
That's right. That's
so
right.
He was saying, yes, these companies give to those things, but I don't receive any of that money. It goes to
so it seems like that the mayor is obviously he just found out about this because you say he wasn't present at the meeting when the comments were made in open meeting. He's responded to them here. So maybe if things had calmed down a bit here over the hiring ordinance, they're still yet to be debated in some respects here, only just a different aspect of it now. So I guess we could say stay tuned or keep your eye out for the story to come out. And so you'll have an update for that, I imagine, a little bit later, I would think, on this as well, too. We're talking with Kelly Smith. She's a reporter for the Michigan City News Dispatch about the stories that she has posted online as well as put in the newspaper in recent days. And Kelly, thank you very much for being with us today. And we hope to have you back on the show to talk about more of the stories that you've done in the near future.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
This is Reporter Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio's Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. With us now, we have Carrie Napoleon with the Post Tribune, talking about a couple stories that she has put out there. First one is from Merrillville, where police were busy. Well, they usually are out there busy fighting crime, but sometimes they do some other tasks, too, that for some strange reason, I guess, comes under the purview of law enforcement. And this is one case they did, and Carrie had a chance to put a story in the paper, online, as well as in print about it. Carrie, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Well, tell us first. Tell us first about the Merrillville police and how their duties sometimes get extended above and beyond the fighting of crime.
Well, it was really kind of just a happenstance thing. I was actually at the grocery store buying dog food, and I noticed all the squad cars in the parking lot, and they were all standing by the drain. And here these guys are working, and they really put in a lot of effort to try and save these dogs. Oh, my goodness. A customer had reported seeing them fall in the drain and called 911 and also told the store. And the cops came, and they just did a wonderful job of trying to scoop them out. And then Officer Ridgway actually went down in the storm drain to get the remainder.
I know you gave credit in your story to the two grocery managers there at Meijer, Tom Galasich and Drew Thomas, for keeping an eye on things. And I'm sure they probably had – it was an interesting experience, I'm sure, for them, first off, because they have two very unhappy customers, unhappy not because of the bad service from the store, but because there were ducks that were trapped.
Yes. And, you know, people were concerned, and they kept walking up and, you know, kind of asking, oh, what's going on? You know, because you see people hanging around a storm drain, you kind of know something's stuck in there. So a lot of people did come up, and the store was really helpful in actually giving them supplies. They brought out a loaf of bread to try and lure them out of the pipe.
Yeah.
So the little ducklings kept running between the pipes from where the area where Officer Ridgway could fit in the drain and its next connection point where the drain cover was.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a small pipe, and that's where they kept hiding. So took a lot of effort to lure those little guys out of there.
Why, they probably thought it was a game, you know? It's like what you play with your dog or your cat, you know? You're trying to rescue them, but they think, oh, this is fun. You know, this is just a game. No, it's not a game. This is real. This is really serious. Huh? Now,
if you could only convey you were helping them, but, you know, they're ducks. They didn't know.
Now, I understand that that even this may have been Officer Ridgway's first experience with ducklings in the drain. Sergeant George Fields, he's a veteran. Obviously, he's a sergeant at the police department, but he's gone through this before, I understand.
Actually, it's the other way around.
Okay.
Officer Ridgway was the only one at the scene who had experienced a duck rescue before. Even myself, in 24 years as a journalist, I've never been on board for a duck rescue before. Other animals just never.
Yeah, not ducks. Yeah, I don't think I recall ever. I've been witness to some myself, but never a duck rescue. That's interesting.
And this was his third one. He said.
I'll be darned.
So he was pretty comfortable rescuing them and handling them. The last duck, he actually snatched it up with his hand. It just happened to come within reach. They had just called the fire department because they were going to try and flush towards one of the openings and scoop it with a net.
Yeah.
And he was able to grab it just on a fluke, and lo and behold, they were done.
Now, I know, too, that in your story you mentioned that Officer Ridgway had an interesting way to get the duck's attention. So I guess he could grab that last duck or all the ducklings, I guess, get them close by so they could get them out. I didn't know that you could put a mother duck call on a cell phone, but apparently he has one, huh?
Well, no, he looked it up on the scene.
He was
like, well, let me check and see. And he pulled it up and started using it. And the other officers and the store managers went to the other drains and made noise so to kind of scare them. So they followed, you know, the mother's sound.
Now, speaking of the mother duck, did they ever find her?
She was hanging around for a while, but then she got a little spooked and flew away. It appears she lived in the retention area behind Meyer. So the officers had contacted a rescue with the help of another customer who had showed up, and the rescue advised releasing them as close to the mother duck as possible. And while we couldn't see her, we could hear her. And the ducklings could hear her, and they started chirping. So you can kind of see all the reeds and the cattails rustle as they move towards each other to reconnect. So it looks like they all got reconnected with her.
Well, that's good. That's very good. And we know that perhaps at a future Maryville Town Council meeting, this will probably come up, and I'm sure there may be some commendation, although it's not completely above and beyond the call of duty for a police officer to make an animal rescue like this. I'm sure it's something unusual, and you say maybe not necessarily one that happens all the time in the town of Maryville.
Exactly, and it kind of gave you a chance to see the human side of police officers. You know, they were really concerned about these ducklings. It was really quite nice.
That's great. That's great. The other story that you were able to cover and post online, as well as put in print in the Post Tribune, is about involving the Dollar General store that is just opening for business on 45th Street in Highland. And we should mention, too, by the way, that a little later in this program, we're going to have a comment or two from the folks at the store. We have an opportunity to talk with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson. She filed a report that we've aired on the newscast about the grand opening for this particular store. But I know when going by there, I've seen a lot of activity, and this is above and beyond the construction. This was after the construction crews were all done with their work, and there were some people, I think, doing some shopping earlier. And apparently one poor soul got into trouble at the store. Tell us what happened, and it's given, I'm certainly a pause for the folks that work at the store, thinking that, okay, we've gotten this brand new store, nothing can happen.
Exactly. They had only been open, it was their fifth day open. They hadn't even been open a week, and the store manager I spoke with in the store, she said she heard a crash, and I had come upon it later. I drove by and I was like, oh my goodness. And she heard the crash and said she knew what it was. She had been in a similar situation once before, and sure enough, somebody kind of ran the curb. The person who was behind the wheel, there were no charges filed. You know, there was nothing nefarious about the accident, but apparently she stopped, and for some reason the car lurched forward. It could possibly be a case of, you know, stepping on the wrong pedal. There's no real known reason. It's just a civil matter, but it put a nice big dent in that store before they even had a chance for the grand opening.
I know, and perhaps you recall this case, too, having covered it or being aware of it in the newsroom, that there was something similar that happened a few years ago at the Munster Donut Shop on Calumet Avenue. And they of course, had closed for some other reasons and did some repair work, and then they reopened again. And then not long after the reopening, a gentleman, unfortunately, I think his foot slipped on the pedal and in turn lurched forward and smacked into the front of the store. So these things, they do happen. They don't happen very often, but they do happen. Luckily, in that case also, nobody was hurt. But they had to do some more repairs to the front of the store.
Exactly. And oddly, I think these happen a little more frequently than the duck rescues. two summers ago, somebody took out the front corner of the Wendy's on Main Street in Crown Point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, these kind of accidents happen. You know, sometimes the cars get hit. Sometimes people hit the wrong pedals. They're not as rare as it seems.
Well, it's something for the employees at the Dollar General store in Highland to talk about with their family members if they haven't already. Something to keep in
for
mind,
sure,
that they have to keep an eye out for in the future. Carrie, thank you very much for all the great stories here. And in this particular case, these two great stories that we've had a chance to talk about today. Carrie Napoleon, a reporter for the Post Tribune, as always, thank you very much. And we hope to have a chance to talk to you again real soon.
Hope so. Thank you, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This is Reporter Roundtable Thursday. That's when we have a chance to talk with media in Northwest Indiana and elsewhere about the stories that they have posted online, in print, or on the air, as the case may be. Let's now turn to some Indiana business news, and it does include one Northwest Indiana story in it as well. Dan McGowan works for Inside Indiana Business in Indianapolis, and he's with us on the phone to talk about these stories. Dan, thank you for joining us on the program.
Good afternoon, Chris. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Here, let's start in here talking first about the situation with the Muncie Community Schools. Many of us, of course, up here in Northwest Indiana, are very familiar with the Gary Community Schools and their financial problems. And during the legislative session, the problems with the Muncie Community Schools came to light as a result of some legislative action in this last session. And now that I guess it's following through in the saga of how the Muncie Community Schools are going to survive their problems, and the latest issue of the I guess the saga comes back to the Ball State University Board of Trustees. Tell us a little about, if you like, some background about the Muncie schools, and in particular about this very interesting Board of Trustees meeting.
Sure. This is sort of an arrangement that it hasn't been done in Indiana, and Ball State says it hasn't been done anywhere else, where the university has taken control of the local school district, in this case the Muncie Community Schools. They have selected a board that was based on recommendations from their own board. So Ball State put out a group of recommendations to the Ball State president, Jeff Mearns, saying these are suitable candidates for the school board. The Muncie mayor also put out some of his selections, and the Muncie City Council put out their selections. And from that pool, the Ball State president selected a board for the Muncie Community Schools that will be overseen by Ball State. As I said, this has never been done before in Indiana, never been done, Ball State says, in the entire country. Mm-hmm. But they will oversee the school district. This hand-selected committee will oversee it. They will hold public meetings, as school boards typically do, but they will be overseen. This board will be overseen by the Ball State trustees.
We should mention here, before we go into a little more specifics about the new members of the board, that Ball State University obviously is not a stranger to public education. They happen to have their own laboratory school on campus because at the Muncie campus, they have the School of Education there. They train teachers to go out into schools all across the state and across the country. And the Burris Laboratory School has been in operation for many, many years, although it started out kind of as a high school primarily, but it's branched into education. So there are people on the Ball State campus that are familiar with a public education and I guess what to do. So they're no strangers to helping help the Muncie Community Schools. It's just unusual they should happen to have something literally in their backyard.
Yeah, that plus Ball State's prowess as a teacher's college. Mm-hmm. They pump out teachers annually throughout the state that go through their own program on campus. But they have experience at this. And this situation, this setup is not something where, say, Jeff Mearns, the Ball State president, is going to have a day-to-day hand in how Muncie Community Schools are run. But there's oversight now that is being commanded by this board that was selected, which the Muncie Community Schools board draws from throughout the community. There was some concern that members of this board would be selected from, say, anywhere else, from outside the state even. Yeah. That wasn't the case. There was one member that that lives in a nearby community, but other than that, everybody selected for this board was from Muncie. One works for Ball State, and then it's kind of diverse from there. There's a couple of attorneys. There's a bank CEO, a local pastor, and an executive director of the local YWCA. So they really... They really kind of branched out and selected a diverse group to oversee the Muncie Community Schools.
I understand that this new school board didn't waste any time in taking up some of the issues that have gotten them in trouble in the first place, namely financial. Tell us how they've structured their 2018-2019 general fund budget.
Well, they've approved. They have not gotten to that quite yet. This first group, which will go into effect, the first trustees will go into effect the first. Mm-hmm. Ball State has selected has approved their general fund budget, the university. But the Community Schools Board will have a lot of budget issues to tackle. That was kind of the primary reason for this takeover and how this even began, was budgetary issues among the Muncie Community Schools school district. But yeah, this new board will take over July 1st. They'll have a two-year process where issues such as budget and such as how they will manage things in the future will be determined over the next couple years to kind of set the tone, set the arrangement for how they will be handling their board business going forward.
One other story that you happen to have available that's on the Indiana Inside Indiana Business website is a story that affects Indiana. It's from the U.S. Supreme Court, actually, about e-commerce. Tell us how the Indiana impact of that's going to be.
Yeah, as it stands right now, online retailers, and think in this case Amazon, Wayfair, those kind. Wayfair was the one involved in this Supreme Court case. They don't have to charge sales tax on purchases unless the buyer is in the home state of the company. And kind of the reverse example of that is I've purchased audio gear from Sweetwater Sound, which is in Fort Wayne. I have to pay sales tax on that. If I were to buy it from a different audio supplier, right now I don't have to do that. Well, this ruling reverses that and opens the door for these e-commerce businesses to charge sales tax to consumers that are not in the home state of the business. And this decision has been really well accepted by a lot of our economic leaders within the state, Governor Eric Holcomb, the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, who has been pushing for this for years. Say they both sort of had the same reaction to it. It levels the playing field for Hoosier businesses, both bricks and mortar and some of those e-commerce businesses that are based within the state.
Now, Dan, I know that there's a brief story that you helped write put in to InsideIndianaBusiness.com about this, and it's a local story also, too, and it's what's been expanded on. We carried some information briefly about it on the newscast, and this is about the acquisition of a Valparaiso-based company by a Pennsylvania firm. Tell us a little bit about the firm that's being purchased and what the new company wants to do with it.
Yeah, SES Advisors in Valparaiso was purchased by this company called Ascensus, and they're a Pennsylvania company. But SES Advisors has a couple of components to their business, one of which is this employee stock ownership plan transaction and financial advisory arm, and that was not part of this transaction. That will stay where it is under the owners in Valparaiso. The name for that will now be SES ESOP Strategies Incorporated. But yes, this Pennsylvania firm bought the rest of SES Advisors, as well as a company in Georgia that they are now overseeing. As of the end of March, this company, Ascensus, had more than 187 $1 billion in total assets, and this company has retirement plans. They have 529 education savings accounts, ABLE savings accounts, IRAs, and health savings. And with this addition, they will add some administrative and consulting sort of duties because of this SES Advisors addition.
Well, it sounds like that the SES Advisors purchase is going to be a good fit for this particular company in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it seems like it will. It'll be functions that they don't necessarily, get into right now. The president and CEO said that it'll broaden their product solutions to existing clients. But, they also think that this addition of SES Advisors adds to their culture and really fits well with what they're doing. This company, Ascensus, really likes the culture and really likes what SES Advisors brings to their company.
That's great. Dan, one last story that you've covered, in fact, it just got posted in the last 48 hours, is from, I guess, comments about a national tour that Facebook is going to be putting out here, and one of the stops that they plan to do is going to be in Indianapolis. Tell us about why Facebook is coming to Indy.
Yeah, Facebook has this, they call it Community Boost Initiative, and it's a program that really involves high-tech training and mainly on their platform, of course, but it talks about marketing. I mean, any type of issue that small businesses or entrepreneurs or job seekers would look to find skill-wise from Facebook, they can go to this two-day high-tech training event. It'll be in October and learn directly from Facebook. They set up not just training sessions, but they'll have presentations, they'll have networking opportunities, but there will also be just straight up one-on-one training on how to use Facebook's technology, how to use their their new tools, and for small business owners and job seekers for which this program is targeted, it seems like it can be a benefit, and they say that it will benefit anybody of any digital skill level, so beginners all the way up to marketing experts. Facebook says can benefit from this community boost program.
Well, that sounds like a good idea. And I know that we're a bit far away from Indianapolis, of course, here in Northwest Indiana, but I'm sure there'll be some business opportunities to make a trip down for this event coming up in October. Is any of our business people up here that are interested to get some more information on this?
Yeah, head to insideindianabusiness.com and the story, Facebook bringing a community boost to Indianapolis. There's a link within that story, and you can connect to more about the program. And it's free and open to anybody. So anybody in Northwest Indiana looking to make that trip, it's all day, both the 18th and 19th of October. So if you make the trip, you will be able to get some use out of this. It's a 50-day tour, or a 50-city tour, rather, Indianapolis among those. And Facebook is trying to kind of boost the digital skills, they say, of 1 million business owners and workers over the next 2 years.
Well, that's great to hear. Thank you very much, Dan, for the information. Dan McGowan is a senior writer and reporter for Inside Indiana Business. And at least for the folks here in Northwest Indiana, we know that this opportunity to check out the Facebook Community Boost in October will be well past the time that it'll be difficult to travel in downtown Indianapolis, I'm sure, because of all the work that's coming up here starting this weekend on I-65.
Yes.
I didn't want to bring that up, but we just need to remind people that you can't drive into downtown Indianapolis for a few days starting Sunday because they're going to do some major repair work.
That's right, and that's already starting to give people headaches here on my commute home. I know it's been a big discussion among people that, that are going to have to now work their way around I-65 as that part of that will close right near downtown Indianapolis.
Well,
but we're in construction season, and I guess you've got to make those adjustments.
Well, look at it this way, too. It'll be an experience for some people who live in the area that work downtown, learning streets that they never knew about and visiting visiting neighborhoods they've never visited before, I'm sure. So,
ever the optimist, Chris.
Yeah, trying to look at it that way, to be sure. Dan,
thank you
very much for being with us today to talk about it.
I appreciate you having me. Have a good day.
You too. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. There are a lot of things happening with films in the city of Gary these days, and not only things that have happened, but things that are coming up for the summer months as well. Let's turn now to the lady who has founded and is the director of the Gary International Black Film Festival. Karen Toering is with us to talk about it. Karen, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Hey, thanks.
Well, first let's take here a look at what has happened, because I know that before we start to actually talk about the upcoming 8th Annual Gary International Black Film Festival, which is coming up in October, let's talk first about the collaboration that you all have had with the City of Gary, working in an art house, a social kitchen, which is the official name of the building there right across the street from the baseball park. But there have been a lot of films that have been shown in recent months here that I think people in Gary have enjoyed. Tell us about them.
We did a pretty comprehensive survey in 2017 about what the audience wants from the Gary International Black Film Festival. So, you know, because that's how we program, you know, based on what people say they want to see and what they want to talk about. And one of the things that the consistent theme that kept coming up was we want films in our community. We want you to come to where we are. And we tried that in 2016 and 2017. Just wherever someone wanted us to be, we would go there, we would set up the equipment, but we found that conditions were rarely ideal, you know, for a theatrical film screening. And so we reached out to the art house and asked, well, what would it look like if we were to basically convert the space into sort of a theater, you know, a mini cinema. And they said yes, and we said yes. And for the last 5 months, we've been screening a monthly film and culinary series. So, you know, Art House, the Social Kitchen, is a partnership that was developed to encourage entrepreneurial chefs, right? Mm-hmm. And so we were like, oh, great. I love eating while watching movies. So we got with the art house, and they paired a chef with each of the films, and we tried to keep the food somewhat thematic throughout the series. And, yeah. And that was pretty successful. The first time, we had just a few people. They were like, what? You movie dinner in a movie in the same place? So we had a few people show up. And then these last two screenings, one, we invited the Michigan City Steppers because we did a film that was about a young girl who was part of a step team. So the Steppers came and brought their families, and we also had, you know, sort of a food that was that young people like, for example, you know, so the chefs basically prepared, you know, something that was more amenable to young folks. And it was pretty successful. And then just this past week, we showed a film about historically black colleges and universities, and we brought in the Black Greeks, the Kappa Alpha Psi, and that was also a pretty successful event. So
That's great.
We might want to continue that of, you know, sort of bringing in the chefs, letting them try out their special dishes based on a theme, you know, because chefs are artists as well, and they, you know, they like that challenge. And then bring in the community in to watch a film, talk about it, and have some really great food.
Now, we know that on television, there was a program, Dinner and a Movie, where basically mm-hmm. they had chefs come on and prepare things, mm-hmm. and of course, then they showed mm-hmm. the movie on TV. But this is better still. This is actually a theater where people can sit and not only enjoy the meal, but watch a film, too. That sounds like a very interesting idea, and I'm certainly sure that others in the community are hoping that you'll be able to bring that back next year, to be sure. Now, besides the film series that you finished up on, one coming up here is, because it's summer, it's going to be time for Movies in the Park, which is, I know, the collaboration that you all have with the City of Gary at Marquette Park. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we also have one of the things that because we are a submissions festival, which means that filmmakers from around the world submit their films to the film festival, and we have a group of folks that volunteer and actually review those films and may help us make those selections for the festival. But we get a lot of short films. And, you know, there's really no place for a filmmaker who has made a short film for their films to get screened before a larger audience. And so we reached out to the City of Gary and we said, what if we did a short film right before the film that in the Movies in the Park? And that way these artists continue to get some kind of, you know, exposure for their films. And so the first film they screened in June was Black Panther. And we were like, okay, let's find a really good short sci-fi related film and pair that with the feature film. And so throughout this summer, every time there is a Movies in the Park, you'll see a short film from an independent filmmaker right before the main feature, and that helps us to continue to help these artists get their pieces out.
That's great.
To the community.
That's going to be great. It'd be very interesting, and certainly will promote the annual Gary International Black Film Festival as well, too, because I'm sure that the people that will see these independent films ahead of the main feature will know about this, and maybe that'll get them interested in getting involved in the film festival come this fall, to be sure. That's very interesting.
Exactly.
How much work do you have to do in coordinating all this with the City of Gary?
Well, the City of Gary is pretty easy to work with.
Mm-hmm.
By the way,
well, that's good to know.
So far they've really been gracious and generous and helping us to, you know, move audiences to the film. So we're pretty pleased with that partnership.
That's right. We're talking with Karen Toering, who is a native of Gary, Indiana, and amongst all of her duties and work, she is the founder and the director of the Gary International Black Film Festival, which, by the way, coming up will be the from 2018 will be the 8th annual such film festival, and it's going to happen in the second week of October. If you will now, Karen, let's focus in on the big festival itself coming up. What first are some of the big features that are going to be available for people to see if they attend the festival this year?
Well, right now we're in the process. Okay, first of all, first things first, the festival is October 12th through the 14th. Mm-hmm. It's going to be at Indiana University Northwest, one of our longtime partners, at the Berglin Auditorium, which is a smaller auditorium on the campus. And we are in the process right now of reviewing films. So if there are filmmakers out there that would like for their films to be screened in the festival and they want us to take a look, they can submit by going to our website, and that is gibff.org, to submit your film. So we're screening right now. We're hoping to have, we've got a couple of films that we've curated, which means we've reached out to the filmmaker and asked to screen their film. And I don't want to reveal the names yet, because that's always the best part.
Oh, sure.
Is learning, you know, about who's going to be at the film festival. Plus, we haven't locked the schedule in. We don't normally do that until September, 1 month before the film festival. We lock the schedule in, and then we start telling people, okay, this is the film. One of the things that always happens every year is people go, well, what films do you have? And if we give you the list of all of the films, there's a 99% chance that you've never heard of it before.
Yeah.
But what we guarantee is that the film is going to be powerful. It's going to move you in different ways. You're going to laugh. You're going to think. You're going to go, I didn't know that about that particular thing or country or person. And that's what we guarantee to deliver.
I guess, as it was happened in past film festivals, that there have been a very interesting mix of films, of narrative and documentaries and dramas, shorts and animated works. It runs the gamut, I guess, of whatever the genre happens to have available. So it's worth checking out by going to IU Northwest, to the Berglund Auditorium, for the festival coming up. Also, too, I know that you have built into the festival some other special events that come along, too. Among them are some other special celebrations that are happening, and something called a Gary Showcase. These are things that happen every single year?
Yes, they happen. We kind of just fell into that the first year that we launched the film festival. We brought in, for the opener, we brought in a little-known independent filmmaker at the time. Her name is Ava DuVernay. Now everybody knows Ava DuVernay for Selma and 13th and Queen Sugar and what's the one about the Disney one that she just did? Anyway, a filmmaker who was at the time emerging, and 8 years later she's doing $100 million films.
If you'd like more information about the upcoming film festival in October, go to GaryBlackFilmFest.com. A well-known discount store has found a new location in Northwest Indiana, in particular in Northlake County. We find out more about it in this from Lakeshore Public Radio, Sharon Jackson.
Dollar General now has a new location in Highland. The grand opening of its newly relocated store at 3325 45th Street is set for 8 a.m. Saturday, June 30th. Public relations manager for Dollar General, Mary Catherine Colbert, says the company thought the town of Highland could be served better with a bigger store.
We're always evaluating our stores and how best to serve our customers, and we decided that the Highland community would benefit from a larger store with a simpler layout. This store is going to be about 8,400 square feet versus 7,200 square feet as what the old store was.
The new location will be just down the road from the old store location, and the new store layout will offer some additional items for customers.
Some of the highlights include the cash register option. The cash register locations are in better places. The seasonal products are featured more toward the center of the store. And then the biggest difference will be there's double the cooler space from the previous store. So it's featuring about 30 cooler doors, which will offer more refrigerated and frozen items.
There will be special deals and free prizes at the grand opening event. The first 50 adult shoppers will receive a $10 Dollar General gift card, and the first 200 shoppers will receive a Dollar General tote bag with complimentary product samples. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. And our thanks to reporters for being with us today. From the Michigan City News-Dispatch, Kelly Smith. From the Post-Tribune, Carrie Napoleon. From Inside Indiana Business in Indianapolis, reporter and writer Dan McGowan. And Lakeshore Public Radio, Sharon Jackson. We'll be back with you on Monday.